I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is food blogger and cookbook author Deb Perlman. She's joined in conversation by Sunset Magazine's Margot True. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Deb Perlman and Margot True.
It is such an honor to be here tonight to introduce Deb Perlman from our favorite Smitten Kitchen. I know I'm not alone in this room when I say that my relationship with Smitten Kitchen has been one of the most constant and joyful in my life over the past decade and a half. How many of you could immediately tell me your top five Smitten Kitchen recipes? You can just raise your hands. We're at 100%. All of you. So today I walked around the JCC and I asked people for theirs. It was a great way to spend some time. From the chocolate chunk granola bars and breakfast slab pie, which our rabbi told me were his wife's favorite lactation snacks and got her through the first 6 months of their daughter's life, to the potato kugel, which was described as a gateway drug to Smitten Kitchen, to the salted brown butter crispy treats, which were described simply with an eye roll of ecstasy, the everyday meatballs, the double-layer chocolate cake, apple tart tatin, the jacked-up banana bread and the millet banana bread, the cauliflower cake, brownie cookies, roasted shallots, crispy tortellini with peas and prosciutto, and carrot soup with tahini and crisped chickpeas and leek fritters, the tortilla de patates, matzo crack, all of the panzanellas, the baked eggs with spinach and mushrooms, beef chili with sour cream and cheddar biscuits, the chicken chili, and my personal favorites, the chocolate peanut butter icebox pie, which I make my friend Marta make for my birthday every year, and she's here tonight, so a little shout out to Marta. And another personal favorite, the seasonally appropriate pumpkin pie with pecan praline topping. It is the best of all possible worlds. We shall make it. I'm not sure there's another chef or cookbook author whose recipes inspire the kind of commitment and passion that Deb's do, that thousands and thousands and thousands of people could rattle off the top of their heads at any given moment. We all know and love Deb and Smitten Kitchen because her recipes work, they're delicious, she tells us why we're doing what we're doing, and where we can take shortcuts and where we really can't, and she writes beautifully and personally. As her readers, we have been with her on this journey that began in 2003, through her marriage, two children, and success beyond anyone's wildest dreams. Her new book, Smitten Kitchen Every Day, picks up where the Smitten Kitchen cookbook left off. The book is deeply personal, deeply moving, and deeply delicious. Deb is joined tonight by Sunset Magazine food editor Margot True, and please join me to welcome Deb Perlman and Margot True.
Oh, so Deb, you are much, much loved, obviously. Well, I thought we might just plunge right in by asking you about a word that you've used to describe yourself, and it was actually in the subtitle of the first book, and that word is obsessive. And I you have a particular kind of obsessive, and I wondered if you could describe that a little bit.
I would say, for me, obsessive is that I want things to be a very, very particular way. And I feel like no detail is too small to get there. I feel like it's often in the details or in the lack of details that I get lost in some recipes. So I kind of, when I'm working on a recipe, I write down everything. I will write down the length of the carrots, the thickness of the carrots. I'm crazy. I just want to have the information there, just in case it turns out to be relevant later. And I tend to, I just want things to taste a certain way. I was a picky eater.
You were.
So I still feel like it's inside me. I want things to be just one way or not another.
Well,
a little totally sane cooking. It's fine. This is the way a normal sane person cooks. I know.
Well, so you were a picky eater. Well, what was your food culture when you were growing up?
Oh, my goodness. What was my food culture? Is New Jersey a food culture?
Of course. What did you eat growing up? What kind of cook was your mom?
Like, fairly normal food, although my mom didn't know how to cook when she got married. And I know she told me the story that my dad decided he was going to teach her because he knew how to make, like, a stir fry and a couple things. And she was like, no. She didn't really care how she was going to learn, but it wasn't going to be that way, which I think is really funny. Anyway, so she's watching TV one day, and she sees the French chef on Channel 13, and she sees Julia Child, and she sees her making asparagus and omelets, and she was like, that's what I want to learn how to make. And so she bought Mastering the Art of French Cooking and kind of, I wouldn't say cooked her way through it, but she cooked her way through a lot of it. Those were sort of her... I did not grow up eating souffles. This is then she had kids.
Very impressed.
No, then she had kids. So I feel like there's definitely this French orientation. And then my mother's always loved California cuisine. She's always loved all the produce. We joke, I think my son figured this out, who's here tonight, that everything that Grandma Judy loves begins with an A. She likes asparagus and avocados, artichokes, apricots, arugula. I could keep going. It's kind of hilarious. So anyway, she likes all of her California vegetables. And so I think it was like the French and then the fresh vegetables and then just like everyday cooking. Most of the food is quite regular.
And did you...
Oh, God, what high. Like, I'm like, it's like, well, we have souffles and we have California produce. Mostly it was chicken, though, you know? Mostly it was chicken. We had a lot of peanut butter and jelly, too.
Well, did you cook when you were a kid? Did you wander into the kitchen and help her out? Were you banned from the kitchen?
I don't really think I cooked that much growing up. I liked it. I wanted to, but my mother probably figured out that she was much better at it if she didn't have... I'm sure this doesn't sound familiar to anybody who has children, that sometimes it's a little faster to get it done if you do it yourself. I do. I always like to cook, and I think I'd help out a little bit, but it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't like, oh, she's going to be a cook one day at all. I don't think anyone thought that.
So when did that happen?
I think it happened when I, like, ostensibly grew up and realized that I didn't know how to make so many of the things that you just kind of assume you're going to, like, become an adult and know how to, like, roast a chicken or make meatballs or, like, how to make an omelet or something. And I really hadn't done most of this cooking. And so I would just grab a recipe and I would say, wow, that could taste better. That didn't taste as good as it should. And that kind of nitpicking over recipes is really when I started, the site. I wanted it to like be like, okay, I've tweaked this and I like it this way. This is the way I want you to make it, or this recipe is perfect. Don't touch it at all. And that was that's really where the site got started pretty soon after.
Yeah. Well, it's you do give people a great deal of guidance, which is part of what makes the head notes so rich and so fun, you know, because you know exactly what you're going to get.
Haven't you been there before when you're in a recipe and you just want like just a little bit more detail, like, or is this right? Is this supposed to look curdled like this? Should I just order pizza? Like, is it over for me? Should I just quit? Like, I just want like I feel like just throw me a rope, you know? You're somebody who worries a little bit, you know, and gets, you know, nervous in the kitchen. I think this is most people when you're trying something new. So a little bit of honesty about how things are going to go and which parts are not pleasant and which parts are going to look off. I wish more recipes had it.
Yeah, so sometimes a longer recipe could actually be a friendlier recipe, right?
It can be.
If it has more explanation in it. Now, this new book, Spintin' Kitchen Every Day, it you say in the introduction that it was not the book that you started out to write. And it was supposed to be about practical, real-life cooking when you're a busy mom with two kids like you are. And then something happened. You realized that wasn't working for you, and it didn't really reflect what you were actually noticing in your life. And could you talk a little bit about what actually happened and what this book is?
It always sounds so neat when you organize it into a few pages in the intro. But, of course, it was, like, real life, you know, messy and more kind of like this. But it was that, you know, when I found that when life got busier, you know, I was looking at the cookbooks out there that are available to you. And I feel like on one pillar you have these very chefy at-home cookbooks. But
they can be, some of them are great, but a lot of them are just really think that you have a prep cooker or a dishwasher or just, it's just not the way we cook at home because they weren't developed for home kitchens.
They have three sub-recipes.
Yeah. Everyone loves a sub-recipe, don't they? Love a sub-recipe. It's a Tuesday night and you get to ingredient 12 and it turns out it's actually on page 214. That's fun. Oh, and it's like, you didn't jar it already? You didn't can it? So there's that. Again, that's not all of them. There are exceptions, but that is a lot of them, I feel like. And then on the other side, you have these super busy cooking cookbooks. And it's not to say that there's nothing useful in them. We all pull recipes from them, but it didn't feel inspiring to me. I sort of feel like if you need something quick to do with chicken cutlets, probably you could go on Google and find 12 or 20 million ideas. You don't necessarily need a book of it when there's so much out there. I felt like if you're somewhere in the middle where you like to cook but don't have all the time in the world, there aren't as many books for people who are looking for enjoyment in cooking, or just food that inspires you. And that's kind of that was the book in the middle that I wanted to write.
Yeah, you have this lovely line in the introduction about how, really excitement should lead you.
Why don't we talk about that more, though? Yeah. We're always what the food doesn't have or how fast it gets you out of the kitchen or how few ingredients it is or how many minutes. I feel like that's usually how recipes are defined. But what about when you're on your way home from work and you're tired and you think you don't want to cook and then something flips across your phone screen and you're like, ooh, that sounds so good. I'm going to go home and make that. And then you don't mind stopping at the grocery store and getting what you need. And when you pull it off, you feel that's the triumphant part. The I want to do a victory lap around the kitchen part. Yeah, I feel like that's the... I don't know. We don't talk about that, which is just how awesome you feel when you pull off a meal that you're excited about versus the whatever you usually make that you thought you were going to be doing that evening.
Right, yeah. The triumphant and unfussy new favorites is the subtitle. And, and you talk about, too, how if you find that recipe that sparks you like that, it has the power to, you say, completely change the course of a day.
I mean, it might be an ambitious outlook, but I can think of times it's done it, because in general, the less I felt like cooking and the less I thought I was going to, and the more excited I am when I actually do and it actually works out. So again, it's not every night. I don't think that we need to be cooking 7 nights a week or we failed as human beings. I think it's just about sometimes it being the opposite of the bad part of your day. It's not just another piece of drudgery or another to-do task. It's something you want to do or that you're excited about. That's not obviously everyday cooking, but it is something that I would like to find on most days.
Yeah, I love that you call the introduction against drudgery. Sort of there should be some kind of poster.
I know. Well, I feel like if we don't need more to-do lists, we already have it. Eating should be a happier thing.
Mm-hmm. It definitely should be. And actually, the Christian Science Monitor said when your first book came out, a great quote from their book review, the writer said, here's one way to rate cookbooks by IQ, a measure not of their intelligence, but of their irresistibility quotient. The ratio of irresistible to less tempting recipes. On that scale, Deb Perelman's Smitten Kitchen Cookbook scores at the Mensa level.
That might be the only Mensa invitation I've gotten. I'll take it.
which of course, made me wonder, how do you create those genius recipes? I mean, for instance, where do you get your inspirations?
You know what? I feel like here's where I'm supposed to say there's this book that I read that nobody else has. But it's not like that for me. I tend to go through phases of gathering, where I'm reading everything and a bunch of new cookbooks come out and I'm tearing through them, or the holiday issues of magazines, or I go out to a few new restaurants in a month and I get a bunch of ideas. And then there are other times where I'm just sifting through those ideas and trying to pull pieces out that I want to recreate. But it's really everywhere. I tend to grab from as many sources as I can. I like the idea of filling the well, and then when you're at a point where you kind of don't want to look at anything food-related ever again, is the point where you want to start sifting through and see if there's anything that floats to the top.
Yeah,
it's a very abstract way
you've mentioned.
It.
Well, you've mentioned sort of print sources? I mean, do you mainly turn to print for inspiration and real life, or you're roaming
around? Really, I feel like, I get the print magazines, of course. Mm-hmm. I read the web versions of the magazines. I read the newspaper food sections. I read food blogs. I read anything I can get my hands on, basically. I get cookbooks, so it's a bit of everything. And then I'm lucky because I live in New York City and I get to go out and try new things and think, oh, I wonder if I could make this sauce at home and put it on something much simpler and kind of play around with ideas.
Yeah. Well, and then when it comes to the actual testing and perfecting, I know that the blueberry muffins in this book, I think you said something like you packed all muffin love into them. Like you made them 50 times or something like that?
I didn't mean to. I just got a little carried away. This doesn't always happen. This is not, like, I don't usually make things 50 times. What had happened, it kind of is a little bit from the first cookbook. I had gotten really stuck on the muffin recipe. I knew I wanted one in there, and I wanted it to have poppy seeds in it, but I ended up making that one also like 17 different ways, and I felt at the end of it that there was nothing new to say about muffins, that they're all roughly the same formula, and they're roughly... I love that muffin. They're plum poppy seed muffins, and I think that they're really good, but I just felt like, is there really anything that new to say about muffins? And then I wanted to make blueberry muffins because we had a lot of blueberries, and I started with this recipe I'd been using for years. I'm like, yes, there is more here. I just wondered if small tweaks you could get. We had a lot of blueberries that summer. I think that was the summer. It was the only thing my daughter ate, and so back then. And so we had a lot of blueberries. And so I just started playing around, trying to see if I could keep that sort of crisp lid and like a really good muffin top that you want to pull off. And then also I like it when it has so many blueberries that it's like barely tethered together as a muffin with cake. Okay, so this is like, this is like for people who like a little bit of cake with their blueberries. And so after feeling like there's nothing else to say, it was really fun to kind of keep tweaking it. Yeah. And I was making it in mini batches. We didn't have 30 dozen. And this was also the summer that I realized that, because I always feel like muffins are really only good on the first day and then they're not that great. But this is when I realized that even like a 1 or 2 day old one, if you split it and just run it briefly under the broiler, they are almost better. Wanted to throw that out there in case you feel like maybe I don't need to make 12 muffins tonight.
Well, and are you ever sort of driven by what's trending, like what's getting good SEO online? Does that factor into any of your decisions, or are you in your own universe of exploration and obsessiveness? And
I'm untouched by the world. I go into my writing lair. Put my noise canceling headphones on. I don't pay a lot of attention to SEO because for some reason, like as soon as I hear the letters, like this buzzing sound, like just I don't know some of the web stuff. I like seeing what's out there. I like seeing everything that's out there. So instead of picking one or two things, I'm more like, look at everything, and then just, as I said, kind of take it all in and then push it away. I love those hands and pans videos. I mean, I don't always want to cook what they're cooking, but they are so fun to watch. I like it all.
Yeah.
But I think what's really important is that you don't feel like you need to do something some way it's already being done. I don't think anyone's going out there saying what we need is more faceless hand videos. Like, we definitely don't have enough of those. No, if it's how you want to express your cooking, it's great, but I think when people are starting off, there's really this pressure to look around and see what's working, and that's exactly, I think, the opposite of what works. What works is doing something that came from your own mind, that that you have a vision, and isn't too influenced by others.
Yeah. Well, and also part of what's wonderful about your recipes is the way you name them. You know, sometimes just something that could be kind of ordinary, like maybe white beans with sage or something, in your hands becomes, you know, pizza beans.
And that was marketing. I was marketing to a 7-year-old, actually. He was 5 at the time. And I had made these pizza. It was called braised white beans and a, you know, tomato and vegetable sauce. It had a very complex, very chefy name. I had to impress strangers. Mm-hmm. And my son, who's here tonight, so I have to watch my words, because there will be a quiz later. But he said he didn't want to eat white beans. He didn't think he was going to like it. And I said, it's tomato sauce with cheese on top. It's pizza beans. They're pizza beans. And somehow putting the word pizza in there did the trick. Yeah. I don't know how. I mean, it really don't need to be 5 for the word pizza to do the trick, though. I feel like that's really all ages. So it was just marketing. It's the same dish.
Well, it repeats itself through the book. I mean, you make things sound so wonderful. And also, of course, the recipe head notes, because you are the queen of head notes. And even something that, you know, you need to make, especially if you have a family, something like, you know, broccoli melts, for instance. Mm-hmm. In the quality of your head note, you just point out what's extraordinary about
them.
Thank you.
You're listening to food blogger Deb Perlman, whose new cookbook is Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. She's joined in conversation by Margot True on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those broccoli melts. What makes them, you know, like, what? Everybody needs to make these.
I think everyone needs to make these. Very bossy, too. See, that's the other thing. You need to make these. That and the blueberry muffins, I understand if you have to go. go home, make some broccoli melts and blueberry muffins. The funny thing with broccoli is that I feel like there was like about 10 years, or like there were many years on the site where there wasn't a single broccoli recipe. And then I had a kid, and I don't know what it is with kids, but they like broccoli. And all of a sudden we were buying broccoli, you know, 3 times a week, and we always had broccoli around, and we always had leftover broccoli. And it was an agreeable vegetable. It was like the vegetable everybody agreed to eat. And so all of a sudden I went from 0 broccoli recipes on the site to like probably a good 15 or 20 in a couple year period. and the broccoli melts were one of them. And it's just this idea of you take just some par cooked broccoli, you chop it up really well, and then you mix it with a lot of very flavorful things, like chili flakes to taste, garlic, lemon zest. There's some pecorino in there, a good amount of salt and pepper, even some lemon juice, if you don't mind the discoloration. And you end up with this, it's so flavorful, you could just pretty much eat that from the bowl. But for the melt, you put it on a piece of toast with a slice of provolone under it, and then you run it under the broiler. So it's like a tuna melt, but with vegetables.
Wow. But it's like it's double cheesed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to keep it real. the pecorino is mostly for the salty kick, but it's just comfort food. It's comfort food for broccoli eaters.
You are also queen of the recipe mashup, I have to say. I mean, everything biscuits, brilliant idea. Granola biscotti, called the sushi takeout Cobb salad.
Okay, that's sort of a mouthful, but yeah, I know. That was a tough thing to name. I didn't.
But it makes such sense. Everything that you get in sushi, why not just put it in a Cobb salad sort of situation? You know, it's sort of like, and actually tomorrow on Sunsets, we're going to do a Facebook Live segment with Deb, and you can watch her making one of these mashups. It's the sticky toffee date waffle.
Oh my God.
And can you talk about how your brain came up with this idea?
I had actually never had sticky toffee pudding before. Oh. I know everyone's like sighing. that's exactly how it is. The first time you have it, you just realize like that everything before that was actually terrible and sad. It's so good, but the thing that blew me away about it is that it's actually there's blended dates in there. It's not like it's a fruitcake. It's healthy. There's fruit in there. It's basically a salad. Anyway, but I found it, so I thought it would be fun to apply that to a waffle. I feel like it's a good holiday dessert, a good holiday brunch. But what I found when I was making the waffle is, with some tweaking, that since dates are so sweet, that I could actually remove most of the, I think there's actually no extra sugar in there. It's fully sweetened by the dates, which is good, because next you're going to make a toffee sauce, and you'll be really glad there's no sugar inside the waffle. So the cool thing is that you can make the waffles, and they're pretty wholesome, I guess. I don't know. It's tough to call waffles wholesome, but it's a good weekday thing. You could make a bunch of them, keep them in the freezer, or if you want to like do it up for the holidays, it's a very good sponge for toffee sauce, which is basically like a salted butterscotch thing with brown sugar and butter and vanilla and then a pinch. It's gross. No, who'd want to eat that? It's awful.
I've know what I'm going to be making next weekend with my family. Let's talk about the blog for a little bit specifically. You have 7 million visitors a month, something like that at this point. And there are hundreds of comments and questions on every post. And as you have pointed out in your earlier book, this is when your obsessiveness really comes in handy, because you actually answer all those questions. You really do. You look at them every day?
I do. I mean, this month doesn't count. I've been a little bit busy, but I try to. It's for me though. I like to see how it's going for everybody else, but it's really useful for me to hear what questions come up and where people have problems. And sometimes I learn a lot. You know, somebody will suggest a swap or point out that two steps, if you combine them, it's actually still quite good. And I find it really helpful. I don't know why anybody wouldn't want to hear everything that's going on in the comment section. So I find it really helpful. And I also think it's sort of cool because, I mean, if you have a question about a recipe in a cookbook, like, what are you going to do? But in the website, you know, if somebody's actually trying to respond, like, how cool that you can get the ear of somebody, and maybe if I'm there at the right time, I can sort of walk you through it.
Yeah, help you in real time. In fact, I was impressed by, you have a section on your site about your first book, and they're all, you know, not many actually, things that people have written to you about in the book. You know, what about this? I needed guidance on this. Mm-hmm. And you've answered all those people. It's just so nice.
I actually just don't do much else though. Like, this is why it takes me 5 years. This is why it takes me 5 years to write a book, and it takes other people 2 years. But I like it though. I feel like it makes me a better recipe writer, because I have so much more. I can tell you, people will sometimes suggest that I make something. I'm like, well, that wouldn't work because of A, B, C, D. And I can list off the reasons that I know it's just not going to go over well, that I would reject it. It has fennel in it. I don't know. Fennel is so... I'm not saying I won't make things with fennel, but I wouldn't make things with fennel and then be surprised that all the comments were, but I hate fennel.
Fair enough.
Can I make this without fennel? What else can I use for the fennel? I made this without the fennel, and it turned out it was just salad dressing because it was a fennel salad, and I took the fennel out. Sorry.
Well, actually, the very first recipe in this book is kind of an homage to one of your readers. The Deli Rye English Muffin. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I was at an event kind of like this, and the last leg of my book tour for the last book, and somebody asked me where I get recipe ideas from, and I'm like, you know, as usual, it took me like 15 minutes to get to it, but I'm like, kind of just from wherever. Like, this morning I was thinking it would be so cool if I didn't have to choose between like English muffins and rye bread toast, and then someone's like, you should go make that. Now you can start your second book. And so I felt like obligated to make it happen, and also it was very delicious getting it there. So this is really just for me, for people who wish that English muffins could taste like rye bread sometimes. It's for me. I hope you guys like it too, but I made it for me.
And I know that this is going to be a hard question to answer, so just whatever pops to mind. What's one of the recipes that people have responded to most, and why do you think it's been so loved?
Oh, see, I like the way you were assuming that a lot of response meant it was a good recipe. Thing, because I feel like there's recipes like the chocolate peanut butter cake on the site that are really, really popular, but of course it's chocolate and peanut butter. It's always going to be like prom queen of cakes. But then there's my husband's mom's apple charlotka, and I was so surprised. She doesn't call it apple charlotka. She calls it apple thing. She's like, she doesn't bake. She's such a good cook, and she cooks every day. She's like a much better cook than me, and she's a much more, like, I'm like, I cook 3 days, so I'm good, but she will, like, cook every day. But she doesn't bake. The only thing she makes is what she calls apple thing. I made apple thing. I just thought, you know, it's actually a very lean cake. It's just, you know, eggs and sugar and a lot of apples, and I thought it would be maybe interesting in January when people are trying it, when they want dessert, they want, it had like hundreds and hundreds of comments at the end of the week, and I didn't expect it at all. Even to this day, I don't know. I mean, I love it too, but I was really surprised by the level of feedback, and I think it's because it's so simple. You don't need to plan. It doesn't need to be like, I'm making a cake for an occasion. You can just make apple thing. Just make apple thing because you want to make an apple thing.
Gosh, well, you do have a way with apples. I've just made the apple crisp. So delicious.
Yay.
And I love the way you go totally overboard with the crumbs.
I'm sorry.
It's just, crumb on
there. Are you saying you're not supposed to have a 1-to-1 ratio of fruit to crumbs? Is that not how crisps are done?
It's perfect. It's exactly what you want in an apple crisp.
It just means that when it's in the fridge and your family keeps picking pieces off, and by my family, I mean, you know, family. Anyway, it means that there's still plenty left.
Well, and the other thing that I love about the blog is the whole segment that you have on there called Disasters. And there's a little list. I'm going to just read some of the titles and see if you can talk about maybe one of them.
Boy.
Okay, there's...
We're airing all of my recipe grievances now.
There's caustic confit.
Oh, that is a terrible recipe.
There's flan flop.
That's lack of skill on my part.
Okay, there's over-the-top irksome quiche.
It was just, I made peace with it later. I did. It took like 5 or 7 years, but
because when you have failures like this, you just like attack it and make it better, right?
Most of the recipes will be a story about how it flopped and then how I fixed it, because I found that more editorially useful on the site than just saying this didn't work and I'm done here. Gone. So that's what I would do in the beginning. But I think these days it would be like, I've always been really bad at making flan. Here's some examples, and here's how I got it right. I haven't written that post yet, but I have some ideas.
And then I have to ask you, because it's a favorite food of mine, the roasted baby artichoke failure.
Oh, that I know it was that one. Okay. So I don't listen to any recipe that says you can just take baby artichokes and put them in a grill. It's not true. They must be steamed or parboiled first. They're too rubbery. They have to be they really have to be twice cooked in some way. You could cook them fully through in a steamer or boiling them, but if you want to grill them, you can't. Even the babies, you have to boil them first. But I didn't know that at the time. I just expected the recipe to know it for me, and it didn't.
And they were like little erasers or something?
Yeah, they were bitter. Uh-huh. They were bitter erasers.
Oh. Yeah, tragic. And then the photography. Jordan talked a little bit about your photography, and it is so beautiful. And the New York Times once said that your appetite is palpable through the lens, which I thought was so well put. But interestingly, in this book you say, I think it's in the introduction, you say, I am in most foods on team ugly food. What did you mean by that?
I meant that I don't have a lot of patience for food styling. I really just want to show the food the way it looks. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you all of my secrets, which is that I don't believe in food styling. I mean, I think it's great if somebody else wants to do it, but in general, this is our food, this is our dinner. I'd like to get 5 or 10 pictures of it and then go eat it. I'm not trying to like spend an hour, you know. So my theory is that most food photos that we think look good, probably most photos, it's not the food, it's the light. And I feel like well-lit photos that have like a good strong shadow or like clear and they're crisp and they're well-lit makes it seem appetizing. I mean, obviously the content helps too, but I mean, I remember one time I had like, I was seasoning short ribs and I'm like, well, I can't take a picture of this. I mean, nobody needs to see like raw short ribs. And it ends up being, I mean, again,
obviously you have to like short ribs, but I actually think it's a very pretty photo because it's the light. It's the, mm-hmm. anyway, so I really, I don't think it's the food as much as it's the light. So my only mm-hmm. food secret is that I just try to shoot by a window and try to get some natural light on it. That's it.
It seems like there's one other thing you do too, though, and it's that somehow your photos focus on the thing that you love about that food. And you can really tell when you look at the photos that you love the way the spoon made the trails in the gravy. And you can see those beautiful trails and how thick the gravy is. And
I shoot on auto, by the way.
You shoot on what?
I shoot on auto.
On auto.
I don't know why in my early years I felt like I couldn't admit that. Now I'm like, I'm coming free with it, and I feel much better now. I shoot on auto. Yeah, I just want to make it clear. I know what real food photographers do, and I do not do those things. So I just, that's
hey,
all.
It works. You know?
Thank you. I'm glad it's working. I'm going to try to keep pulling it off, pulling off this hack.
Yeah, because it's, it's really... You said I think you talk a little bit about photography on the site, and you talk about how the photo should tell the story of your love for it. You know, essentially that's you're finding what you love about it as you take the shot.
I think that the best photos really do tell a story, mm-hmm. and I also think if you're taking a photo of something and you're not happy with it, it's because it's not. The photo isn't saying what you want to say about it. It's mm-hmm. it's a communication breakdown, so I feel like if there's something you think is really cool about whatever you're shooting, that's mm-hmm. really trying to figure out how to, you know, close the communication gap between what you think is cool about it and what you can get the camera to, you know, tell about it is. Mm-hmm. But I think that's true of writing too. Where it's about this, like, when you don't like the way something sounds, it's because it's not the way it sounds in your head. And the more you write, the easier it is to close that gap between mm-hmm. how you want it to sound and how it is sounding.
Yeah, until it's expressed. Yeah. I am curious to know what a day in your life looks like. Like, when do you get up? When do you bustle into your tiny kitchen, which now is bigger, from what I understand?
A little bigger,
it's not as small as it used to be. New York, you know. What does your day look like?
Well, my husband's here too, so I have to tell the truth. because normally I would be like, well, I get up and I pack lunch boxes. Like, you would hear this booing from the back of the room. I would say a normal weekday it should be that we would both wake up and both together do the lunch boxes and breakfast and whatever, but that is... It's just not honest. My husband took it over at some point, and he's really amazing. And I think I was pregnant and, like, really tired in the morning, and so he started doing the lunch boxes, and then I was, like, nursing, and I was a little busy in the morning. And so he took over breakfast, and then I wasn't doing either, but don't tell him, because I was really... I'm not doing either now. So my husband handles a lot of the morning routine with the kids. Then we divide and conquer. We each take them. Their schools are in separate directions, so we switch off who takes whom. And then after that, if I'm being super good, I will go to the gym for a bit. I'm not always that good. And then I go through my phases. And then what I really try to do at the end of each day, because this relates here, is to kind of organize what I'd like to cook the next day and have some sort of idea so I can write my grocery list. So I try to get my groceries in the morning. I basically just try to get everything done in the morning. And then I use the rest of the morning to... It would be if I was updating the site or if I was writing or trying to respond to emails. That's sort of the couple hours that I have that I can be useful in front of a computer. And then around 1 o'clock, like, my brain just melts down and I can't write or type sentences anymore. And that's when I start working on recipes. That would be a typical day. And that usually pushes us right through till dinner time. Mm-hmm. So hopefully one of them turns into dinner. but sometimes it doesn't.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I know what I am making for Thanksgiving.
What are you making?
And I am going to make your chocolate pecan slab pie.
Good choice.
And it looks...
I'm making it too, by the way. I'm a big fan of all-purpose Thanksgiving desserts. I mean, there are so many things that we like to eat on Thanksgiving, and we only have one stomach, so I love the idea of combining things. Yeah. And so this is like you get your chocolate and you get your pecan pie.
And it's a slab.
Yes. The slab is because I don't know how your families are, but I don't think I've ever seen a Thanksgiving with less than like 12 people. And we're not even from a particularly large family. It's just that if somebody's cooking, mouths appear who are hungry. Mm. And I find that it always gets large. And a pie serves 8 people. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine spending all that time working on pie, toasting the pecans, making it caramel, and then everyone just gets a little sliver? Like, that's very sad. So I like slabbing the pie so you can get many, many more servings. And I also like the proportions. I feel like you get a little more texture out of it.
Yeah, more crispy, crunchy
more corners,
crust. You know?
More edges.
Yeah.
Mm.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features food blogger Deb Perlman, whose new cookbook is Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. She's joined in conversation by Margot True. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, with that, it might be time for your questions.
So a couple years ago, your pecan pie recipe came out with golden syrup. And, of course, that weekend, I went down to figure out how to get the ingredients, and I found a local British store who sold golden syrup. And I went in, and he was like, oh, are you from the blog? Oh, yeah.
I'm so sorry.
The lady
this
called me.
This is what we
me.
Should give as door prizes.
Yeah. But one thing, I was just so impressed. He was like, oh, yeah, she called me. She warned me that I should up my stock of how much I should be carrying. Is that something you do often?
I don't think I have. I don't think I do. I feel like there is. I feel like I would, but I didn't. If I was telling people to go to a very specific store in New York, I might call them first to see if they had it. But no, that sounds like a very nice thing. I should just take credit for it, but I don't think it was me. I would like to be that nice of a person.
Hi, Deb. So maybe it's the millennial in me, but I really love your Instagram stories.
Thank you.
I'm really... they're so funny. And then even when I do cook one of your recipes, I always tag, like, @Deb or @SmittenKitchen. And you always comment back, and it's the most amazing thing.
Thank you.
I, like, screenshot it and text it to all my friends.
Thank you.
Even when I feel like it's a failure, you support me, and it, like, it just really increases the connection that everyone's talked about with your blog. And I just had a question. How do you see your Instagram and your social media kind of relating to your blog? Do you see yourself going in one direction or the other? Or do they complement each other? Just how do you feel about social media?
I think they should complement each other. I think the Instagram stories are, they're fun. I mean, if I'm not doing a lot of things, they'll be quiet for weeks. And then if I'm doing stuff I think is worth sharing or relates to food, or it's been super fun since I'm book touring and going to all these cities, and I wouldn't normally go to the site and be like, by the way, I'm in this city today and I had a milkshake. Like, it's not necessarily good blog content. It's sort of fun to be able to share the behind the scenes of what's going on. And also, it's been super helpful in crowdsourcing, like, where to go. I'm so spoiled that I can say where should I go to lunch, and then have like many, many ideas that I like actually delete the question after a few minutes. But it's awesome. So I like it. I think they should be complimentary, though. I don't think I could do on the site what I do on Instagram. You know, I couldn't write. I mean, you could maybe write something longer, but the recipe's never going to be properly formatted or anything, or searchable, or even hard to get to a link. But I like it. I think I've always liked Instagram because it's very visual. I probably don't use Twitter as much, although with 280 characters, I'm free. Maybe I'll start using it more. I think they should all work together. I think if you are starting out and you're trying to figure out what to focus on, it's important not to get... I think you should figure out what your main thing is that you love and that you want to be known for, and don't get too distracted by the other stuff, because it doesn't matter if you're doing all of your social media and all of your Facebooking and this, if you would like your site to grow, if you're not putting time into it. So it really is, you've got to pick what your center is and work on that first, and everything else should go with it.
Hi, Deb. My name's Jennifer. I had a two-part question. My first question is, what is your kids' all-time favorite dinner that you make for them?
Okay.
And then the second part is, have you considered making a cookbook dedicated to kid-friendly recipes, like things that you as a mom make? Because quite honestly, there's not a lot of them out there. I can think of two cookbooks off the top of my head that's dedicated to, like, moms make these recipes for their kids, and seems like your thing.
All right. My kids like pizza, pasta, and cake. They are normal children. There's nothing wrong with them. One of my kids is a pretty good eater, and he'll eat more things. I like a lot of the things in the book were things. I don't talk about the other kid. I don't know where to get started. She ate a blueberry, I think, in 2016. A lot of the stuff that ends up in this book, though, were not your usual stuff that you would expect to go over great with kids, but it all worked, which was, for me, kind of the delight. And also, there's this kale Caesar in there, which was actually the thing that got my kids to like salad, because neither of them... Well, my daughter would sort of chew on leaves sometimes, but... No, she would. She would eat lettuce, but somehow this dressing just is sort of that magical annum that's really like they will both eat salad. And I'm sorry, like when you... That's why I started with the pizza, pasta, and cake, because I don't, like, could you imagine a food writer being like, my children love salad with kale in it. Like, you sound like you're really bragging. But it was one of those surprise things that I hadn't expected to go over so well. No, to the second question. I do not want to write a cookbook for kids. And the reason is that I want my kids to eat my food and not the other way around. And I know that sounds mean. I'm willing to make some tweaks. I'm not going to cover it in hot sauce and then, like, wonder what. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I hope that the books reflect that, though. Again, it's not perfect, but, like, certainly this book has been... I can tell you which things were... You know, I do usually mention, like, my child would not touch this, but we loved it more for us kind of thing. I feel like the fastest way to get drained in cooking is to cook what everybody... You know, like, I feel like when I talk to mom friends or dad friends, if they do the cooking at home, as soon as you've got one kid who can demand one meal and another kid who can demand another meal. And it's like you're just, it really stinks to cook. It stops being fun. So I am much more interested in taking the things that I want to cook and finding ways to make them more friendly to kids. And that Cobb salad is actually a good example. I found, I basically can verb anything, and now I'm like trying, I've been Cobbing salads, which is just this idea of taking something with a lot of ingredients and sort of separating them out so everybody can, so the person who doesn't want this in their salad or this touching this can work it out in their own bowl. I also like doing it with classic Cobb ingredients, and then, you know, you can also have more of what you like. But I love that idea, and I've been doing a lot more like assemble your own type meals to try to get the kids involved, where you like the street cart chicken, where you have everything kind of separate and then you make your own platter. I think it's more fun. Mm-hmm. And then again, you don't have to not make something because there's somebody who hates yogurt sauce or something. Mm-hmm. Kind of monster. I don't even know.
Hi, my name is Lena. Yours was one of the first food blogs I discovered, and it's still the first place I go to whenever I want to cook something. I was also a fellow picky eater as a kid, and I was wondering if there are any ingredients that to this day you will not include in your recipes.
You know, these used to be my secrets. Like, once a year, somebody would email me and be like, I've noticed you don't have any beet recipes on the site. Or, how do you not have any salmon? And then I'd be like, it's kind of amazing how rarely that happens. I think when you cook, people only notice what you do cook. I know I'm in the West Coast, and I'm saying that I don't love salmon, but I don't. I can't. I tried. I know you're going to send me. I'm going to be hanging up so many salmon recipes in my inbox tomorrow. If I only just made it this way, it's going to, here it comes. I beets are not my favorite thing, which is funny because my husband's Russian, and I know his mother-in-law. I mean, I won't not eat them, though. It's not, what else? God, let me think.
I don't know, I was always a really picky kid, so actually I could probably more easily list the things that I would eat, but there's a lot of things that I just don't, like, that don't move me, but a lot of the cooking I've done on the site in the last 12 years has been, I thought I didn't like chicken breasts, and here are a few techniques where in which I actually really think that it's the best way to cook them is with this meat. So my favorite thing is to take things that I don't think I like and find a way to make myself like them. I just haven't succeeded with those two things yet. Yes.
This is sort of a request, not a question.
Okay.
But can you update more recipes to use a multi-pot or Instapot?
Please. Yes, you got it. What I've been doing is I did get one. Purely reader service. I got one because I was cute, because I'd heard one or two things about it in the last 5 years. Like, maybe you've heard. I bought one. It took me a couple months to open it up. I've made a bunch of things in it. I feel like a slow cooker, it's good at certain things, and it's not great at others. It's not that it won't work. It's more what you want to get out of it. I feel like if you're trying to look for a meal where you can throw a bunch of things in a pot, you know, come home, throw a bunch of things in a pot, like, you know, chicken, rice, vegetables, and some seasoning. Go take your shoes off, help your kid with their homework. 15 minutes later, it's ready to go. It's great for that because it's, you don't have to stand over the stove. I feel it excels in cooking at, you know, obviously if you're trying to braise meat, it helps if you really want it, like, falling apart, done. I love it for dry beans. There's a black bean soup recipe on the site way back in the archives that I make in the Instapot now, and it's 30 minutes. The cooking time is 30 minutes, about 25 even, plus 10 to 15 to saute the ingredients. I mean, it's pretty great to be able to, like, come home and make a black bean soup from a bag of dried beans in 45 minutes. And I like making stock in it, or bone broth if you want to charge a lot for it. the kids call it bone broth. I think it's really good at that, and it's really nice that it takes less time to get way more flavor. I've made the grandma-style chicken noodle soup in there. And actually, one thing I found when I was doing that is there's a couple steps where you just want to simmer it for a bit. And I actually thought it was pretty cool that you can do that in the Instapot. You can actually bring a pot of water to boil, which is pretty cool. You can't do that with a lot of other multi-cookers. Oh, and also, I've never given a short answer in my life. I was visiting America's Test Kitchen when I was up in Boston. It was really nice that they invited me and let me walk around, because the last time I was there, I stole some fried chicken. It's a story. It's a different story. but they invited me back, and they are working on recipes for their own multi-cooker cookbook, and this actually relates back to the flan flop. They were making flan in there, and Whoa. They had me sample too. Good. So perhaps that's the answer to my flan woes. It was so good. I don't know if that was the first thing that would come to mind with it, but do know at some point in the next year or two, they're going to have a cookbook out that might be worth it for the flan recipe alone.
So I think it's your husband that's a chocolate peanut butter lover, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not, but it I'm not going to, like, drive across town for it or anything.
Oh, I will.
Okay.
So I have a question. When is his birthday? Are you going to make something new for him? Because I always look forward to his birthday because there's
something. Oh, I see what you did there. Well, I can promise it here because I think he had to go. So I can say whatever I want.
I tried it intentionally.
The number of homemade birthday cakes we got vastly plummeted after we had children, because children's birthdays are like a month-long affair that require multiple desserts and parties. And then when you have two, you're so winded from it that you don't want to. It takes a while. But every so often, I pull it together for us grown-ups too. And yes, I would like to make something new, and I have some ideas.
Okay. Can I just add that there is a brilliant, like, cake explosion at the back of this book. It's like so many cakes packed, you know, cakes every which way. Yeah, and plus you have four dessert chapters in here.
I mean, it's incredible. I just, you know, I think it's important to be prepared. But, you know, the site is fairly divided between sweet and savory. The book is a little bit more savory, but I like it to show up. It's probably about the same balance as the site.
Okay, yeah. Just when you buy this book, you will see in it the Party Cake Builder. And it is just how to do all these incredible things, you know, basically using some, you know, the same basic recipe, but then done, or a few basic recipes, but then all these different ways to customize them, and it's just
beautiful. It's all one bowl cakes, and it's just, I just feel like my theory is that most people are making birthday cakes at like 2 o'clock in the morning, the day of the kid's birthday, because you thought it was going to be real quick and you'd start it after their bedtime, and it never goes quickly. And I wanted it to be very, very, very simple, like high reward cakes, though. You know, they're not single layer, or you can just stack them, lots of frosting, lots of sprinkles.
Yeah, I love the one bowl. I mean, you use one bowl as a verb.
Yeah, I know. I verb a lot of things that aren't verbs. I don't know why you think I should write more. it's just one of those things that when I think of like the unfussy part, we make these assumptions about cooking that you have to sift the dry ingredients and do the dry, wet, dry. And it's not that that doesn't make a good cake, but these were all times that I made it without those steps and found the cake to be lacking in no way. Maybe the crumb would be 10% different without it, but I don't think anyone's eating that cake thinking, my goodness, if only she had sifted her dry ingredients and folded them carefully in. No, nobody who deserves to eat cake you made would think like that.
Hi, Deb. Hi. I'm just super curious. Okay. If you have a team that supports you in the business of Smitten Kitchen, do you have people behind the scenes that are helping make this all happen?
No, I don't. It's like this weird thing. I used to think it was fine, but recently when I started, when I've answered this, people are just like, their jaws drop. This is why I'm very slow at everything. I don't know. I always say I'm going to like hire somebody and then I don't do it. I have help. I don't plan my own book tours. Like my publishers take care of that. I'm not booking all these. I would never leave my apartment if I had to book it myself. I have a little bit of help with my newsletter. But no, it's because nobody can write for me. Nobody can answer emails for me. Nobody, you know, so it's really tricky. I've never been very good at figuring out what I could outsource on the site. I did move my site over to WordPress. I mean, it was already using their software, but I had a tech guy sort of managing it, and now I'm in with WordPress VIP. So it's nice to have people kind of managing the back end now, but no, pretty much the day-to-day of the site is all me, and it's not necessarily the best thing. Don't take business advice from me, because I'd probably be able to do a lot more things if I could figure out how to outsource more, but when the site and your work is your voice, like it's hard for me to figure out what I can outsource.
Hi, Deb.
Hi.
My name is Daphna. I have a blog question. Okay. Your blog was one of the things that inspired me to start my own blog about 5 years ago, and it's a little tiny blog, and I pour my heart into this blog. I'm super obsessive, as like you described before, and I was wondering if you have any advice for how to launch blogs into the world so that more people are reading them.
I think it's great to be consistent, you know? I think one of the best things is that when somebody shows up at your site for, you know, don't underestimate drive-by traffic. I think that's the entire reason my site exists. I've never advertised it. I've never bought an ad. I'm so uncomfortable talking about my site even now, as you can, like, I'm squirming in my seat. I feel like it has to stand on its own. And so keep working on making everything there good. So when somebody stops by because of a Google result, or they followed a link from somewhere else, or maybe they found your Instagram and you're linking back there all the time, they don't want to leave. Just think of that person who stops by and doesn't, it's not because somebody told them about it. It's just they just landed there and they want to stay. And I feel like if you can make it welcoming for that person, people come back. And maybe they tell a friend about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was food blogger Deb Perlman, whose new cookbook is Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. She was joined in conversation by Margot True. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. B Vina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.